The dust has finally settled from New York's legislative primaries in June, and to assess what we've learned about the electorate, we're turning to Bruce Giori, a senior advisor with the lobbying firm Manat, Phelps & Phillips, and an adjunct political science professor at the University of Albany. Welcome back to the show, Bruce.
Thanks for having me.
So to set the table, June 23rd was an election day unlike any other in New York. We had a zombie Democratic presidential primary, a special election run for Congress in Western New York, and legislative primaries all over the state, with basically any eligible voter able to participate by mail, depending on the performance of their local post office. At this point, what do we know about turnout? For example, how did it compare to previous presidential primaries or even legislative primaries in New York?
Well, when you compare it to the hotly contested presidential primaries, which in recent times was Obama and Mrs. Clinton in 2008, and then Bernie Sanders and Mrs. Clinton again in 2016, it was relatively low. But if you compare the legislative primaries to what you would expect without a functionally contested presidential primary, because by this point, Sanders had long since endorsed Biden, it was a very high turnout. So if you compare it, there's no apples-to-apples comparison because we've never had one like this. You're right. Procedurally, this primary was the aberration of all aberrations. But because of the absentee ballot voting, it was a much higher turnout in the legislative contest than in the two separate primaries in 2018. So it was a higher turnout overall.
While there are still paper ballots potentially left to be counted in parts of New York City, did we glean?
And the congressional races still have not been officially certified,
right,
which is Carolyn Maloney in the 12th and the open Serrano seat, though everyone expects, including yours truly, that Richie Torres will wind up winning that primary. But, you know, we're coming close to 6 weeks since the primary, which is a problem.
Right. And so based on the paper ballots that have been counted so far, have we been able to glean anything about the voters who were maybe more inclined to vote by mail?
Yeah. Because we don't have anything definitive because there were no exit polls and we haven't, you know, we don't have the final number, so it's tough to tell. But clearly, the progressives had a good day. We had earlier in the spring or early summer, had a conversation wondering, could the progressives turn out their vote in the absence of door knocking, which has been their staple? And they did a very good job of using social networking, a point that you had made in our last conversation. Could they make up for their lack of door knocking ability? Because who would open their door in the middle of a pandemic, particularly in New York City? Could they do it through social networking? And the answer is yes, they did. And then the functional advantage we all thought the incumbents would have in terms of garnering a majority of the absentee ballots, these progressive challengers more than hung in there and held their own. In fact, three of them were able to win, were behind in the machine count, but wound up winning when the absentee ballots were counted. Although admittedly, absentee ballots historically are between 4% and 7% of the total vote. And this year, because of the fear of the pandemic and getting infected if you went and voted in person, those absentee ballots, depending on the district, were most often a majority of the votes cast rather than machine ballots. So the progressives did well, but their strengths and weaknesses remained what they were. They're strong from Peekskill to Plattsburgh geographically. I like to call it either Hudson North or Vermont West. They're strong in New York City districts that are gentrifying, particularly if the progressive standard bearer is a candidate, is a minority candidate who also gets the gentrifying votes. They do less well in bedrock black and outer borough Jewish and white Catholic districts. They don't do well in Long Island, and they do less well upstate west of Albany. So Albany's kind of the dividing line. West of Albany and more moderate suburban voters tend to do better. But you can't take away the fact that they are ascending, but not ascendant. And my critique of some of the pundits is by looking at some of these pockets where they did very well, Bowman beating Engel, Mondaire Jones winning the open Lowy seat, almost beating Maloney, winning three, knocking out three incumbents in Brooklyn and another three in Queens, that by doing well in those pockets, it means they're ascendant. No. And if you look for comparison, in 2006, a progressive challenger, Jonathan Tessini, got 17% of the vote against Hillary Clinton in 2006. In recent statewide primaries, they're up to about a third of the vote, nearly doubling their support. That's ascending. You can't gainsay that. You can't gainsay that they have these pockets of support in Western Queens, in the gentrifying portions of Brooklyn, but they're not yet ascendant. They're nowhere close to a majority. So they're ascending, but not ascendant. That's the trend that I saw.
You mentioned
from the numbers.
You mentioned some neighborhoods. Is it about those areas that pose the biggest threats to establishment candidates, whether it was 2018 or 2020?
Yeah, I mean, it's what's the old French saying? I won't bore you. I wasn't a good enough French student to remember the French words, but the more things change, the more they stay the same. If you look what's going on in Western Queens and in the gentrifying portions of Brooklyn is not that different than what went on in the 20s, in the 30s, when socialist candidates were winning some legislative races in Manhattan. I mean, there were two socialists. They didn't call themselves Democratic Socialists then in Manhattan, Vito Marcantonio and a gentleman named Leo Isaacson. So this isn't the first wave of socialist candidates we've had in New York. And we saw the reformers in the early 1960s with the Beat the Bosses campaign. And we also saw the anti-war candidates do well in pockets of Brooklyn in Manhattan in the early 1970s. But what we found out is that demographic changes were driving that more than ideology. And what happens is the candidates who become the lightning rod for these demographic changes, they're motivated by their ideology. But the question is, will the voters sustain that, or do the voters move in a different direction? In those earlier cases of hard challenges to incumbents, over time, the Democratic coalition was able to absorb those Democratic changes, and it didn't upset the apple cart. Now, we don't know here. This may be, past is not always prologue. But the question is, will they be able to grow outside of these clear pockets and take it statewide? One interesting race in Queens, where they had these successes in the borough president's race, Donovan Richards, the Democratic organization candidate, won handily by sweeping the black vote in Southeast Queens, and the progressive candidate, Councilman Constantinides, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, he finished third. So even in a multi-candidate field, the progressive was not able to win. Because guess what? Queens has 18 assembly districts, not just three. But again, he did well. Constantinides did well. But he wasn't in a position, even in a multi-candidate race, to win a countywide race. And that's the challenge for progressives. Can they grow their coalition beyond their base in these demographic pockets to compete for offices like mayor and controller and ultimately governor, lieutenant governor, the statewide races? And that's the challenge going forward. Or will they start losing their flock as the more mainstream Democrats learn how to appeal to those voters? And we don't know. All that's with a question mark.
Well, you say appeal to those voters. It seems like part of the tack that the insurgent candidates took was engaging voters who might not have otherwise voted in a normal Democratic primary. So it seems like they're the ones who can tap into this new base, whereas the establishment already has, its threshold.
Except when they challenged Greg Meeks in Queens, a congressman, Nydia Velasquez, a congresswoman from Brooklyn, Tom Suozzi in Long Island, and Joe Morelli in the Rochester area, and Adriano Espaillat in northern Manhattan and parts of the Bronx, all those incumbents won by landslide margins.
I'm saying they have a ceiling, though, whereas these challengers
in
some cases haven't hit it.
Progressives challenged them, and And I mean, the difference is when you have a vibrant, youthful minority candidate running with strong progressive support in a demographically changing area, they did well. But where those same kinds of candidates went up against not an older incumbent who was perhaps a tad tired and had perhaps made a few mistakes and was just a little and not as attuned to the newer campaign techniques, they didn't do nearly as well. In fact, they lost in landslides.
Well, the handpicked successors, though, for Joe Morelli, well, successor one removed, and David Gantz's successor in the assembly, all lost handily to insurgent candidates.
Yes, that's true. But we can overread into each race is its own, and what you find is we all in the pundit class we want to paint Rembrandt portraits when in reality a little bit of impressionism comes in, and you have to see, well, you know, who was the better candidate? And what you find is more active, aggressive candidates do better. But, you know, it's hard to argue that the progressives overwhelmed things in Monroe County when Morelli won as large as he did, or Swazi ran as large as he did, or Greg Meeks wins 4-1 in Queens.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Bruce Jory, a senior advisor with the lobbying firm Manat Phelps & Phillips, and an adjunct political science professor at the University of Albany. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.